Dan, how's it going?
Howdy doodly.
You got those cassettes? You're slamming those cassettes into place again?
Oh, is that what it sounded like?
Yeah, sounded just like that.
That was just my internal monologue getting louder.
Great.
Bursting through.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 3 of Trickle Down Socialism. We've got a fun show in store for you. We hope it's informative. And I hope Dan keeps up with his usual bit of keeping us entertained as we talk about tough topics. Dan, I hear that you had an interesting phone interview that's going to be part of this podcast.
That's correct. So my friend Jake Bennett is an emergency room nurse in the Boston area, and he talks about what it's been like most recently and the issues of personal protective equipment. And we do at the end get into a conversation about poop, but don't worry. It's not what you think, but I'm going to just have to leave that poop hanger, if you will, right at the beginning. You might have to let that thing hang on.
Yeah. My youngest has had a few poop hangers recently, which is kind of tough.
You don't want to pinch it off too soon.
No, it's more of a, I've pooped my diaper. Let me show you by pulling down my diaper here and now, regardless of what's going on around us.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. Beautiful is an interesting word for that. But yeah, and I've got a few, just some details that I've been focusing on as I continue to learn about this and, ways that I think things could have been handled differently. One example of kind of egregious corporate socialism, but hopefully that'll help us, get in the right mind state to be ready for that interview at the end of the podcast. So stick around, folks.
We'll be right back.
This week's episode is brought to you by homeschooling. Homeschooling. Hey, bet you never thought you'd be a homeschool teacher. Well, guess what? Now you're stuck inside of a global pandemic with several little people that look just like you, who need you to feed them and keep them off screens. Otherwise, they'll probably develop an addictive habit that will take years to break and may come up in therapy sessions later in life. That's right, homeschooling. Something you never planned to do, but you're doing it anyway.
Hey, Pat.
Hey, Dan.
So, I think today was today's Tuesday. So today was supposed to be a Wisconsin primary vote, despite all of the social distancing precautions. I think from what I know, at least the last 3 or 4 weeks since we've been social distancing, every other state has postponed indefinitely or until June. What's going on with Wisconsin? Why did theirs not get moved forward?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting case. Now, Wisconsin does have it written into their state constitution that they have to hold this vote. And so they are, unlike other states where that's not explicitly mentioned in their constitution, there is that bit there. Now, however, the governor who is a Democrat, has been speaking with health officials and has been working really hard to try to postpone this vote for the safety of her state. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, what ended up happening was the governor issued an executive order over the weekend because the legislature was not jumping into action and was not willing to postpone the vote. So the governor tried to take it into her own hands and issue an executive action to get it done. Unfortunately, the state Supreme Court, which has a majority of Republican judges, struck that down, and they had to go ahead with the voting. Now, Wisconsin's an interesting state. It's a swing state. We know it's always in play. Mm-hmm. It played a huge role in 2016. There are spots of really heavy Democratic voters, like Milwaukee, Madison, Wisconsin, but the rural parts of the state are tend to be much more conservative, and their legislature, the state legislature, is has a pretty strong majority of Republicans. Now, here's kind of what this is something that really gets to me over and over again about Republicans and their approach to voting access and voter suppression on the other side is that they know they've done the numbers and they know that if you get more people out to vote, you're going to end up with more people from the Democratic Party getting elected to more seats.
Yeah, so why is that?
That is because when you do the numbers across the nation, you have more Democratic voters, more people who lean Democratic than you do people who are Republican. But Republican voters tend to be older voters who are much more, you know, reliable voters. They'll vote regardless of what's going on. But usually this is something that's unsaid, right? Mitch McConnell's really careful not to say it out loud and not to say it publicly. But Donald Trump just went and said it a few days ago and saying that when he was asked about a move to make the November elections vote by mail, he said, if we go to vote by mail, you know, Republicans won't be able to win for a long time. And so he just said it. You know, he said out loud what Republicans often say behind closed doors or things that they think when they're, you know, not being held to account like this. So they wanted to hold this vote because they knew that turnout would be way down. And there were other seats. There were other people on the ballot aside from just the presidential primary stuff. So, you okay over there?
Yeah. Do I sound okay?
Dragging some things across the room for a little while.
That's just my fat stomach. Nothing to be alarmed about.
So I think this is frustrating. It seems like people are putting political wins over the health and safety of an entire state. And that frustrates me. But it also frustrates me because we see this kind of undemocratic side of the Republican Party saying, you know, we want turnout to be low, as low as possible. And it's the same voter suppression stuff we saw in Georgia, you know, with Stacey Abrams going up against Kemp for the governorship. It's a sad state of affairs for our democracy, I would say.
Yeah, no kidding. And we're not even close to done. I mean, don't we still have like 30 or 40% of the states still to go? So could this battle play out a few more times in the next few weeks?
Absolutely. Yeah, we could see this in states where you have that kind of it's a pretty even balance in terms of voters from either party, but you've got maybe a governor who's a Republican, or in this case a state legislature who's a
Pennsylvania is coming up, right?
Yeah, all these states will all be interesting to watch, and hopefully they won't be cases like this where people were forced to go out into, you know, the community where they know that the spread of COVID-19 was much greater. The risk is much greater as a result of them having to head out.
Right. Can we shift gears a little bit and talk about ventilators? I've been hearing that states have effectively been competing against one another in sort of one of the governors called it basically like an eBay type situation where you'd have a bidding up. Obviously, it's supply and demand to some extent, right? If there's not enough, then whoever has the most money, which would seem to advantage either the federal government or maybe more affluent states.
Right. Yeah. So this is a really another frustrating piece of this. And you heard Governor Cuomo talking about it. You referenced it with his eBay comment, but it just doesn't make any sense. So normally you would hope that you could have all the states get together and say, okay, we all need this number of ventilators. We need this number of masks. We need this and this. So let's just push all those requests to the federal government, have the federal government put in orders from whichever vendors they need to go see. And then the federal government can then distribute all of that equipment as needed and as each state requested. Right. But unfortunately, what is happening is the states are competing against each other, driving up each other's bids. So making it really hard for smaller states with much tighter budgets to even compete for those ventilators. And, you know, you've got this mess of, you know, one state ends up winning a bid. You know, they've got this number of ventilators on the way, and then another state kind of like cuts them off at the pass. And you saw that with Bob Kraft sending the Patriots plane to pick up masks because they kept getting intercepted. And there's just this, it's a disarray. It's a lack of
organization. He sounds like a true Patriot to me.
Right. Nice one there. But it's also just, it's just frustrating because in a time like this, we should all be working together, but we've also got, you know, a vindictive president who has kind of punished states where governors have criticized him. So Michigan got short shifted on some of the things that they wanted. Massachusetts, California, so states are effectively getting punished because the president is upset with them. So there's that piece to it. But the real piece that just doesn't make any sense is that they're effectively competing on an open marketplace and driving the cost up for everyone in the process. Now, there's another piece to this, which I find to be a real link to kind of what our mission is as a podcast, is to explain what, you know, socialism could do and how socialism could change, you know, the way our country goes right now. And that is, 2 years ago, they set out to put together a really strong, no, 3 years ago, they set out to put together a strong stockpile of ventilators that could be held centrally by the federal government and then distributed to states in the event of this exact type of crisis. A stockpile of ventilators. Now, in order to do it effectively, they wanted to work with vendors who could not only produce a bunch of ventilators, but also figure out a way to design, manufacture, and market a ventilator that was much less expensive. So they got a company on board to do it, and the company was going about the process. And then somewhere in their process of getting their new ventilators, they'd have to get approved then by the FDA. Before they even went for approval from FDA, they put a stop on it as a company. And that was a stop that was pushed by the shareholders of the company because they were afraid if these new, much cheaper, but also just as reliable and just as effective ventilators got out on the market, that would just tank the market that they had already built for their much bigger, right, much better known ventilators. So essentially you have an example of capitalism kind of striking down this progress that we would have had, having more affordable ventilators, and then at the same time striking down the federal government's ability to stockpile ventilators and have them at the ready for this type of emergency.
So did the federal government come out of that with nothing or just a diminished amount?
No, they came out of it with nothing in terms of a stockpile. They were able to stockpile, you know, a number of ventilators, but nowhere near what was recommended by the pandemic response team. So they ended up way shortchanged on that. And as a result of the chaos that is this White House, no one really circled back and followed up on it to make sure that they,
well, there was no pandemic, right? So,
right.
So
right.
It kind of, no one would have predicted this, correct?
That's correct.
Isn't that the line that we keep hearing?
I think we heard that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I do want to circle, just like kind of take a look around the world from time to time and see what's going on in other countries and how they've responded. And one country that stuck out to me as I was doing this look was Vietnam, which has not yet had a fatality from
that's crazy,
from coronavirus. And they have had a number of infections. Now, Vietnam, if you remember your U.S. history, the U.S. withdrew without actually winning anything. So in other words, we kind of left and they were left to figure out some form of communism or socialism on their own. We didn't, at the time, our goal was to stop socialism from spreading from the north to the south. And we ended up leaving them to their own devices. And they came up with a kind of a socialist nation, right? So one piece about that, they, over the last, between 2002 and 2018, They've lifted 45 million Vietnamese out of poverty through their socialist measures of increased education, job training, all that kind of stuff. But in terms of their response to COVID-19, they acted swiftly. And because they had a centralized planning center of their government, they were able to just rapidly shut down flights into and out of Vietnam. They shut schools almost immediately as soon as the first few cases cropped up. They put in place, they ramped up testing right away and then contact tracing, as we've seen in countries like South Korea, where they very carefully reviewed where everyone who had tested positive had been over the last week and tried to track down all of those potential exposures. But they have just done a phenomenal job. And I think it's largely due to the fact that they have, a socialist nation with people who kind of have trust in the fact that their government is out to help them, and because they've seen that happen in their lives.
It reminds me a little bit of Singapore. I know Singapore is more of like a capitalist society, but Singapore also has really low cases and they were very swift to act. Were there other states that you wanted to, or countries that you wanted to talk about, or that was just one example?
I wanted to bring up Vietnam, but, and this is kind of like a bullet point kind of all over the place list, but this is kind of what I've collected over the last few days of news that I think highlights where our country has fallen short, but also where socialism could have kind of changed things. And, you know, that brings me to my next piece here, which is that we have a bit of another example of kind of corporate socialism, or in this case, kind of insider trading, which we saw the senators who dumped all their stocks right when they first heard that coronavirus was going to cause a ton of disruption. And even though they publicly told people that it wasn't going to be a big deal, but I have been really curious as to why Trump has been so adamant that hydroxychloroquine is like the cure-all, like the golden bullet to solve this COVID-19 pandemic. And I just like, it was like, first I was thinking, oh, he's doing it because he wants to make it seem like there's something out there that's just going to make this all better, you know?
Yeah, silver bullet.
As his normal way of kind of downplaying it and saying like, we're going to fix this optimistic view. But I knew there had to be something else to it, and I couldn't put my finger on it as to why the hell he's so focused on this one drug that actually, if you look at studies, the studies that have been done have been really poorly done with kind of really bad data and not very good methodology. And we come to find out that Trump owns a pretty large stake in Sanofi, which is the French drug manufacturer that manufactures hydroxychloroquine. So that's just another mind-boggling example of what comes out of our capitalist system that has very few breaks in place to prevent someone in government from profiting off of something that they're directly dealing with. The conflict of interest this large kind of screams at you.
So this French company has like a patent on
hydroxychloroquine. Yep.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you're just full of information.
So the last point that I want to make in this kind of random grab bag of issues that I've seen coming up as a result of COVID-19 and the U.S. response to it, is that we've started to see some work stoppages, some strikes. We had some grocery workers striking in the Boston area recently. There's talk of Amazon strikes.
Instacart.
Instacart and some of those other grocery delivery services had some strikes. And Uber and Lyft also had a strike. And, you know, you have reactions from some people. I've heard some people say, oh, well, this is the last thing we need right now is to have strikes when the country needs these people the most. And what I say to that, being, you know, the good unionist and socialist that I am, is to say that this is exactly the time when you have the most power, right? So the strike, it only works because you have the power of all workers joining together and saying, we're not going to work until these conditions are met. And so for some of these strikes we're seeing now, it's like, we need to have personal protective equipment. We need to have some better safety measures in place. Otherwise, we are very likely to get infected. And that's totally understandable. But I did find something that I thought was really interesting. And that is that this is nothing new, that strikes around a pandemic has happened before. So one of the big pandemics that's brought up most often when we're talking about COVID-19 is the Spanish flu of 1918 mm-hmm. and 1919. The Spanish flu came through once and then it kind of died down a little bit over the summer of 1918. And then in the winter of 1918, 1919, it came back again and struck even harder. And it was in 1919 that the biggest, the most widespread work stoppage in U.S. history occurred. It was 1/5 of U.S. workers across the country went on strike in one form or another. And so the reason I bring it up is, first off, I think it is actually a time of crisis like this is actually, I think, an opportunity for us to kind of reassess and say, what are our priorities here? Do we want to prioritize grocery workers? Do we want to prioritize these people who might be low paid, but they're deemed essential, right? So why is it they're deemed essential and their paycheck says otherwise, right? But this is also, it's just an example from history that shows us that, you know, we might be in for, you know, some reworking of our priorities here. And if workers are focused and are able to band together, as we see them doing in some of these examples, then we could have some positive changes come up as a result of that for this work.
Yeah, I totally agree. And there's a good piece in today's Boston Globe about the grocery store workers. And what they're asking for, is pretty mild. They're asking for gloves and masks while they're waiting on people who could very easily have the virus. Additional paid sick leave. I mean, during the coronavirus, I can't imagine not giving frontline workers sick leave, and then time and a half hazard pay, which if you think about it, I know plenty of people who work, you know, if you work on a Sunday, or anyone in the medical industry, if you work overnights, right? All those people get time and a half. That's a very common practice. Time and a half of $15 an hour is not outrageous when you consider, I'll bet you after all this is said and done, places like Stop and Shop and Whole Foods will have done pretty well for themselves.
Right.
Their shelves are, you know, barely ever fully stocked.
Right.
So I don't think these are not radical demands. Right. They're basically saying, can I live? And by the way, the Boston Globe article is talking about Boston area grocery store workers dying,
right.
You know, who were at work, you know, left work sick or, you know, came home sick and very well may have died because they were serving you and I groceries, you know. So this seems completely reasonable to me, even if it does fall under that dirty S word.
Right. That's right. It's you and me groceries, but that's fine. So, yeah, I think you make a good point there that these are really baseline demands. And I don't think as consumers or Americans, we should be turning our ire against those workers. And I don't think people are. So that's where striking workers win. You see it with the teachers who went on strike across the nation in multiple states over the last year or so. They had a ton of public support behind them. And so that's when strikes end up winning for the worker.
Right. And we can't, this is not a time to go without your grocery stores. You know, imagine if, you know, 100, 200 years ago, if we were all left to fend for our own food supply.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I know you have chickens in your backyard, but right. not all of us are, you know, suburban hippies.
Right. Hey, so I'm excited to hear what happened in your interview with.
Yeah, so we'll be right back with my friend Jake. And he actually, interesting tie into what you were just saying. He talks about how actually his hospital, because of the coronavirus, is making less money. And so nurses at his hospital are not getting raises this year. Wow. So that's another interesting development. You would think not that hospitals should be for profit, but that they are actually losing money because of the coronavirus, which is a weird paradox. But
right.
So please stay tuned and we'll be right back after this message.
This week's episode is brought to you by Fork Knife Butter Royale. Fork Knife Butter Royale. Hey, Fortnite, get out my way. I'm Fork Knife Butter Royale. Fork Knife Butter Royale for only $5,000 on your app store.
Hey, Jake.
Hey, are you there, Dan?
Hey, yeah. Welcome to Trickle Down Socialism. We are so thankful for you making the time to talk with us. Could you just start by telling our listeners where you work and what your job is?
Yes. So I work in the second busiest ER in Massachusetts. I'm a registered nurse at a hospital just outside Boston.
Awesome. And could you tell us what a typical night, because you worked the night shift, right?
Yes.
What a typical night looked like before the coronavirus and how it has changed most recently as the numbers of cases have gone up?
To be honest, prior to COVID-19, we had a very high volume, which is why I said the second busiest ER in the state, is that we have a high volume. We see a large number of traumas usually. We saw over 2,800 traumas in 2019.
Wow.
It's usually very busy, high volume, high census. And actually, since the COVID-19 has been actually getting worse, our volume is down. Our census is
strange. Low, interesting.
Which gives us concern. Obviously, because most hospitals we've stopped our elective surgeries and outpatient procedures and visits, rightfully so. But that's a large source of income, and we're a nonprofit hospital. Most hospitals are nonprofit. There's only a couple for profit in Massachusetts. So that's our main source of income. This has negatively affected us. I mean, nurses aren't getting a raise this year, and so on and so forth, simply because the money's not there. The low census makes sense. And the fact that people are afraid of getting the coronavirus by visiting the ER, which also tells you something about pre-COVID ER visits, that how many of them are actually emergencies.
Yeah, maybe people don't have health care or primary care.
People
doctor.
Shouldn't be coming to an emergency department for non-emergent things.
Right.
So right, exactly. The simple, I've had a headache for an hour, or I stubbed my toe, or I have a cough for 30 minutes. Actually, the cough, they are coming to the ER. The coughs are coming. But our census is low. We're seeing mm-hmm. spikes, and we're seeing less beds that are available upstairs.
Okay. And we hear a lot in the media about personal protective equipment. Can you talk about if that's a concern of yours? And if so, is it the masks and the gowns, or is it bigger things like ventilators?
It's everything. It's not necessarily one particular. Go ahead, buddy. Your turn. It's not one particular thing. It's changing. It's ever changing what we're running out of, because once we get supplies or something else, we run out of another item. Go fish. Playing
sure.
a very invigorating game of go fish right now.
But oh, okay.
Okay, go take a break. Go to that. So.
You don't mean go fish for personal protective equipment.
No, well, sometimes it is. So what it is, and our hospital's doing the best they can, and it is I do know, because I talk to the director of emergency medicine. I do talk to the director of nursing. They are tirelessly every day trying to source a place to find PPE. And it's an ever-changing, evolving thing that our PPE is changing every day. We have
sure.
new gowns, new this and that, because we can find them from our manufacturer. Our standard manufacturer is out. Right now, before this, we weren't to wear a respirator unless we were doing an aerosolizing procedure that would cause the virus to go airborne. Now, CDC recommends anytime you come in contact with somebody who's suspected of having COVID, you're to wear your respirator all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Previous to this, we were wearing surgical masks over that respirator to increase the longevity of the respirator. Now, we are low on surgical masks, and so now we're to be wearing face shields that cover your mask.
And do you dispose of the face shields afterwards?
Partially. No, you clean the face shields and reuse them. Okay. You're issued one from the hospital.
So it belongs to you, basically.
Yes, and I don't have one.
Oh.
I gave one to somebody who didn't have one. I wear goggles. And people wear cloth face masks on top. But here's the thing. Cloth absorbs any particulate or moisture and needs to be disinfected after every single use. And the filtration rate of a cloth mask is about 30 to 40%, whereas a surgical mask is about 80%.
What does that mean?
It filters it can filter virus and particulate on inspiration. So it's pretty. Surgical masks are very, very, very important. I mean, the number one thing we do is when somebody comes in, you give them a mask. It keeps them from aerosolizing or coughing or putting any droplet in the air.
Right.
So,
and what I've heard is, this is mostly from politicians, but that with different states now seeing different peaks in the virus, that often states are competing with one another for this gear. Do you think that's true of hospitals too? Like our Boston area hospitals, kind of, if one place buys them up, that means the others won't have.
No, I don't think that to be true as far as hospitals competing for one another. You basically have a handful of hospital groups in the Boston area, and they all work within each other. Partners shares partners.
Right.
And, you know, the Brigham shares Brigham. And the good thing I can say about the Boston area hospital is very cohesive. We all take care of each other. We all look out for each other. I know that yesterday BMC's volume is so high that they actually put out a call. It's called EMTALA. It's basically EMTALA makes it unacceptable for a hospital to divert patients away from their emergency department. Yesterday, they asked EMS to divert to other hospitals because they're full.
Right. By BMC, you mean Boston Medical?
Yes. Yes.
Any idea why theirs might be higher? You think the city probably has a bigger concentration of cases?
Well, it's simple. It's simple. I mean, closer living conditions, higher population density. That's why the Boston area hospital is going to be hit harder.
That's why New York is the biggest.
And the suburb hospitals are going to be hit because that's where the when I say I work at the second busiest ER, we have a large population in the suburbs of Boston, have a large population of what we call skilled nursing facilities, or LTACs, long-term care facilities, nursing homes, as people call them, but there's various degrees. There's long-term, there's short-term, there's rehab, there's LTACs. This is basically a petri dish and could be a catalyst. If one person gets COVID and it goes through there, you're talking 100 residents that with obvious comorbidities and of the really bad age to get COVID can be infected, in which case that can very, very easily overwhelm a community hospital.
And so that's something you're concerned about.
It's already happening. Yes.
Okay. So is there anything as a member of the general public, other than staying inside and washing our hands, should people in the public know?
So this is a point that I've argued or discussed with people, that they stay home. I mean, stay within your living capacity. Go outside of your house, go for a walk, be smart, go shopping if you have to. But when you do go shopping, and I tell people, treat the world like it's covered in poop. You know what I mean? If you touch something,
is the world covered in poop?
If you touch something, wash the poop off your hands. Oh, I'm going to go outside. Right. There's a doorknob. There's poop on it. You touch it, you wash your hands. You sanitize. It's like if the world can understand that everything is covered in poop, i.e. COVID and or feces, whatever, you'd be a lot more hand washing, cover your face. It's one of these, as far as face masks go, yeah, wear them. If you have them, that's fine. the 6 foot rule is for droplet precaution, which means somebody sneezes or coughs and there's droplet and it lands on you 6 feet, it shouldn't touch you. It's actually 6 to 9 feet. If you will not catch COVID if you're walking beside somebody and breathing the same air. That's right. A big misconception. Social distancing, yes. Don't go to a big party. Do I think if there's a cul-de-sac for family members and the dads or the moms want to have a glass of wine and they sit in lawn chairs in their yard 6, 10, 20 feet apart, I think that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Don't congregate at the mall. Don't go to large groups. Don't have birthday parties. Be smart. Common sense is no longer common, but have some common sense.
Right.
Treat the world like it's covered in poop. Wash your hands. Keep your hands away from your face. If wearing a mask does nothing but keep your hands off your face, then wear it. That is probably got to be the number one vehicle for this virus, is that people touch things that have the particulate on it, and then they rub their eyes, they pick their nose, they bite their fingernails, and then you have it.
Because it's invisible. It doesn't hurt or burn your eyes or anything.
It doesn't. Right.
The virus cannot be detected, really, until it's too
right.
late.
Right. Like your best friend Donald Trump says, it's an invisible scourge.
It's the hidden enemy.
Yeah.
It's coming for us.
Right.
Well, Jake, I know you have stuff to do. We appreciate you reminding us that the world is covered in poop.
Yes.
And on behalf of the American citizens, thank you for doing what you do.
Hey, just doing my job. Thank you, Dan.
All right, man.
All right.
Talk to you soon. Yeah.